Nicholas Boggs' new book, Baldwin, A Love Story, offers a fresh, intimate portrait of James Baldwin. Drawing on letters, archives, and conversations, Boggs traces Baldwin's search for connection across Harlem, Paris, and beyond, revealing how love shaped his politics and his prose. Boggs, a noted Baldwin scholar and co-editor of Little Man, Little Man, brings a critic's rigor and a storyteller's grace to this icon. We'll talk about romance and kinship, chosen families, and why Baldwin's radical tenderness speaks so powerfully to our present moment. Again, the name of the book is Baldwin, A Love Story, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Boggs to the roundtable this morning. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a big book, and there's a lot of love within this book, you can tell. I'm curious as to what the original intention was and how close you came to that in the end.
Well, the original intention was to bring Little Man, Little Man back into print, which was this children's book that Baldwin collaborated on with a French painter who was believed to be deceased. But over 20 years ago, I tracked him down in Paris. And before he died 2 years later, we were able to work together a bit. And then 2018, the book came back into print. So that was the original intent, and to sort of write about the story behind that book, which turned out to be a love story, is one of Baldwin's last great loves. But sort of organically over the course of many years, it grew into this larger book about relationships that I only towards the later stages understood that it could even be understood as a biography per se. So it was a long, long process of research and writing and just organic, or everything coming together organically.
So the organic part of it is different than saying I have a mission statement, if you will, and these are the questions that I want to answer. But I assume you had that too, and they sort of merged together.
They did. I think the questions were, you know, what are the gaps in Baldwin's life story? And there were many of them, as it turned out. And how has that impacted our understanding of him as a cultural figure, as a writer? It was clear to me, you know, there were several really important biographies early on by David Leeming and James Campbell, and these were fantastic and important, but they were written, you know, 30 years ago before there were sort of changes both in sort of the availability of archives, but also in how Baldwin was sort of being conceived as a figure. He was sort of in the aftermath of their biographies, he was sort of forgotten and his reputation was sort of in decline. And then in the early 2000s, he started to sort of come back into cultural visibility. So my questions were really, okay, how do we look at him now with the new archives, and how do we look at him now in terms of seeing him in all of his fullness, you know, as a Black writer, as a writer who had these deep relationships with other men, but also important relationships with women, as a writer who lived in Istanbul, who lived in the south of France, who was a transatlantic commuter. How do we look at him? And especially how do we look at these relationships that had been, some of them had been paid attention to, but not with sort of the depth and microscopic approach that I tried to take.
What do you think the original, as he started to publish, what the original reaction was?
When Baldwin started to publish?
Yes.
Well, when he published in these sort of smaller essays, like Commentary and The New Leader, and, you know, before he left for Paris, he wasn't, you know, there wasn't too much of a reaction. It was really after he wrote Everybody's Protest novel, where he sort of made a name for himself. And he actually wrote that from Paris. It was about Uncle Tom's Children, but also Richard Wright's native son. And it was in part a takedown of Wright, but it was also his effort to kind of psych himself up into writing, finishing his first novel, Go Tell the Mountain, which was very well received, that novel. So by the time that came out, he had sort of established himself as somebody who was both important as a fiction writer and a nonfiction writer, and it only, you know, accelerated from there.
Was he comfortable in both, in the sense of that there was perhaps a deeper love for fiction, or and the need to write nonfiction, that they did go hand in hand with one another?
Thanks for saying that. I believe they did go hand in hand for him, and I do believe that we have to read them together. He thought of himself, I think, in his heart of hearts, as a novelist. I mean, I think he really, that was his sort of first love in a way. I mean, also a playwright. When he was in junior high school, he wrote that he wanted to be a playwright. But for him, he had to work through in some ways in his nonfiction what he had to work through in his fiction, and vice versa. So he wrote Another Country, all about these, interracial, complicated interracial relationships in the fictional realm. And then he turned around and wrote The Fire Next Time, where he made a call to black and white Americans, but white Americans in particular, to kind of come to grips with the history of American racism. So he was working through ideas in both genres, I think, and in his poetry as well, and in his plays. So it was important to look, I think, at all of his different works together in this book.
The subtitle of A Love Story, that's I didn't understand it until I read the book. And those are the best subtitles, aren't they? But I'm curious as to what led you to that of thinking in that way.
Well, I say this in my author's note when I sort of give a thumbnail sketch of how the book began with that discovery of Little Man, Little Man, and my interest in that relationship. And I end it by saying, I didn't know that I was writing a biography, but from the very beginning, I always knew it was a love story. So that the subtitle didn't come until the very end, but it has multiple meanings, I would say. I mean, first of all, I really wanted to focus on stories and storytelling. And thank you for what you said before. Didn't want it to be a dry recitation of his life. I wanted it to be told through these narratives, or put people in their places, put people in the places where he went, like Switzerland and Corsica and elsewhere. But also, I think that his whole life revolved around love, and I think his legacy has become a love story for many people. I mean, some people said, Deb Willis said to me, "Oh, Baldwin is my love story." So I think people have a connection with Baldwin in that sense as well. So I wanted the subtitle to have that kind of many layers to it, both within Baldwin's life, but also surrounding Baldwin and how people in the world feel about him today.
He called himself, he said this about himself, and you read about this, as a transatlantic commuter. And when you talk about the places that he went and the itch that he had to travel and to go elsewhere, what was that? Because commuter is an interesting word choice, because it's not a transatlantic traveler, it's a commuter, as if going in and out of work in a situation and exploring as you're there.
It's funny, he wrote to his brother, I think it was his brother David at one point. He said, "Don't worry, I'll be back to New York soon. I'm moving between Paris or Europe, and New York seems just like coming from Brooklyn to New York at this point." He's doing it so often. So, I think that's a really important term to him, because the press in particular, would say, "Oh, he's an expatriate," or "he's given up on America," or "he's, And he was very adamant in saying, "I am an American. I just need to be elsewhere to have the perspective to write about this country." And also, he had to be somewhere safe. I mean, he was being followed and surveyed by the FBI. Of course, people, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, Martin Medgar Evers, his friends, they were murdered. So, he was living a kind of a dangerous life. But I think the bigger issue for him was that he really needed to be in a quiet place, and in a place where he felt that he was both safe, but also a stranger. He really kind of drew on his experience as an outsider in many, many different ways. This perspective allowed him to reflect back on the condition of America, and of Black America in particular.
Nicholas Boggs is our guest. The name of the new book is Baldwin, A Love Story. You write of his relationships, and basically four men in his life that meant the most to him, that he loved the most. And those are fascinating stories and glimpses into not only his relationships, but the connection to his writing itself.
Yeah, Baldwin was very close to his family, so he supported them. They supported him, especially his brother David. But when he was abroad, he had to create these alternative kinship structures, and that's really part of what I was interested in this book. Where how did he create the conditions of possibility for survival, but also for writing such important works across so many genres. So Buford Delaney, the first figure, is this amazing black painter who was he was not romantically involved with, but he was his quote spiritual father, and he met him when he was 16, and he introduced him to jazz and blues and taught him how to see the world as an artist, and eventually followed Baldwin to Paris, and they had this sort of lifelong kinship relationship that was very sustaining for both of them. Lucien Hapersberger was the great love of his life, he said. He met when he was 24 and Lucien was 17 when after Baldwin moved to Paris. It was Lucien who took him away to Switzerland, where he was able to write his first novel, Goatheld on the Mountain. He dedicated his next novel, Giovanni's Room, to Lucien, and they had this very complicated on-again, off-again relationship that softened towards the end into a kind of familial one. But they were probably, he called him the great love of his life. The next figure, Engin Cezar, a very famous Turkish actor who Baldwin met in New York because he was actually playing the role of Giovanni from the Actors Studio workshop. And Baldwin followed him to Istanbul in 61. That's where he finished Another Country. It's where he wrote The Fire Next Time. It's where he considered Istanbul his home for the 60s, and he considered Engin his blood brother. And he actually called each other that. And then finally, Yaron Kazak, the collaborator on Little Man, Little Man. He was Baldwin's lover in the 70s, but also a friend and also a collaborator. He's also the man that Baldwin dedicated his novel If Beale Street Could Talk to. And if you look closely at the archives at the Schomburg, you can see how much Yaron's presence in Baldwin's life impacted drafts of various novels and other manuscripts that didn't come into being.
Is it possible to think that one of those relationships could have been longer lasting without the outside pressures of the time itself?
That's a good question. I mean, the one with Buford was long lasting, although they faded. They didn't fade in and out of each other's life, but it was a very, very intense relationship, as very much like a relationship that one has with a parent,
Yes.
Baldwin. The other relationships, I think that Baldwin was drawn to these men in part because it was impossible for them to be together. I think this is basically what Yaron Kazak told me, when I finally asked him the question point blank. I don't want to give too much away from the book, but I think Baldwin needed both this, that's why his letters are so remarkable, because there are these letters about yearning, and how much he both needs to be with somebody, but also with somebody almost in spirit, but be on his own writing and be yearning for them from afar. And then they'll get back together and they'll break up. And you see these love triangles in his fiction that he's actually living out in his life. So, I think Baldwin yearned for a kind of domestic relationship, but he also maybe didn't seek out the relationships where that was actually possible, because in a certain sense, he belonged to his art.
And then, of course, there are the relationships with women in his life who were writers and very strong presences and served as a very strong presence in his life. Toni Morrison for one, Lorraine Hansberry for another. And what was it that even put them in the same orbit?
Well, Lorraine Hansberry was very important, very, very important to Baldwin. He wrote a couple of essays about her, which are wonderful. He met her when that Giovanni's Room workshop was happening, and nobody seemed to really like it, including Lee Strasberg. But there she was in that small audience, and she came up afterwards and said really positive things about it. And this was right before the big hit of A Raisin in the Sun. They had, unfortunately, Lorraine Hansberry died very young, but they had an intense and very close relationship for a number of years there, where she was actually one of the people who was pushing Baldwin to move for to become more radical, to move further to the left. She was a committed radical socialist, so she would kind of push him, and they would joke about it a little bit. But she did shift his consciousness a lot. Toni Morrison, I mean, he would read out loud from his novels to see if he was getting the female voice right. I mean, they had a beautiful relationship, particularly in the 1970s. He also supported writers like Gail Jones. He had relationships with his school teacher, Bill Miller, when he was growing up, who took him to see plays and movies for the first time. And they remained lifelong friends, another kinship structure that sustained him. There was also Mary Painter, this fascinating, brilliant American economist that he met in Paris. And he said, If I can't marry Mary Painter, then there's no woman I could marry because they were that close. They were really, she was a great, great love of his life. And the letters that he wrote to her are extraordinary because they detail his creative process as it dovetails with his love life, as it dovetails with his movements across. I mean, he's writing to her from the South when he's having a nervous breakdown, because of the cross is being burned. So these letters are just unbelievable, and it was such an honor and a privilege to be able to engage with such incredible primary texts like those.
Given what you just said of cross burnings and such, how would you characterize his relationship with his own country, given his travel back and forth, and even that commutership of what his relationship was with the United States?
It was fierce. I mean, he always said, I love my country, and that's why I reserve the right to be as, to be as judgmental and critique her as much as is necessary because of that love. I mean, whether this was always heartfelt or if it was strategic at times, as he was as a nonfiction writer. I mean, he is up for debate, but at least in his published writing, he had a some people, especially earlier in his career, thought that he was too much of an American exceptionalist, that he didn't have enough of a kind of global vision, although that developed later in his career. But he was an American writer. He was a committed, novelist and fiction writer, and his essays in some ways were part of this long tradition of the American Jeremiad. This is what he was part of. I mean, you wonder today how he would feel, because by the later in his life he was saying things like, how much time do you want for your progress? I think he was getting very frustrated, after the kind of the hope of the Civil Rights Act and things like that. Things did not move the way that he thought that they would or hoped that they would. So I think he got quite frustrated there later in his life.
When you look at where you leave this book, and it's such a complete portrait, and yet I assume you have hope of what people will do with this information, and really the avenues of inquiry that can take place as a result of it being written.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people writing about Baldwin, which is wonderful. So it's not, this book is not, there's a chorus of scholars and writers, Eddie Glaude, for example, Dante Stewart, Peniel Joseph. There are many people out there writing about Baldwin or through Baldwin. So that it's exciting to be part of that. What I do hope, in terms of my emphasis on the storytelling, there's this kind of narrative that young people don't get Baldwin. Like, they love Baldwin, but they don't read him, or they reduce him to sound bites. And I'm really not sure that's true. At least when I was teaching college, that wasn't the case a few years ago. But either way, I hope that this book, because I hope it's very readable, will get young people into Baldwin's life. So they'll read his work, but also they'll understand how recent this history is. So it was really important to me, for example, that the photos and the insert, which were that they were in color as much as possible, because we tend to think of the civil rights movement as in the past, right? But in fact, it was quite recent. And as we're seeing right now in the world, like, all those issues are very much present with us right now. So it's important for young people and for everybody to understand that this is a living history, this is a recent history, and that the project that Baldwin gave white America in particular, that they had to grapple with the nation's past and present and sort of get rid of this idea that we're innocent just because we weren't born. We weren't alive during, the period of slavery. Like, but we have to, we can't erase this historical reality because it's still so with us. So part of my hope is that we'll just keep these stories circulating among our youth, and that Baldwin will not be reduced to a soundbite, or even worse, that his message is erased. That's the real danger.
Do you feel that in his time felt that he was making a difference, that he was having a difference on a troubled world that was going on then, that continues to go on now?
I think very much so. I mean, his brother David talked about how in his later years, he would say, Baldwin would say, "I hope that, somewhere in the wreckage, I produce something that's of use to somebody somewhere. And of course that, you know, he's being self-effacing a bit, because at other times, I think when he got the Legion of Honor from the French government towards the end of his life, he, in a late interview, he talked about how he thought about his father and his grandfather and all those fields of cotton, and how he felt that this award was for him, but it wasn't for him. It was for everybody who was part of that terrible history and that's the struggle. And he was very selfless in a certain way. So I'm not sure he would want to say that he alone was making this big difference, but he knew. I mean, he knew, because he wouldn't have kept, you know, fighting the way that he did. He wouldn't have kept truth telling the way that he did if he didn't understand on some level that he was having an impact, because he certainly was.
The research, the writing, the published writing, the letters, the research, deep research that you did, the interviews that you did, the people that you talked to, I assume you never thought of that as wreckage.
I didn't, but I thought I had him when he, I, there was a moment where in one of his letters, when he'd finished, he was writing about his life, and he said, you know, oh gosh, you know, someday some like PhD student or biographer is gonna write, you know, is gonna discover this stuff and gonna think like, what a crazy life or whatever. And there I was, sort of, you know, looking at it. He said it more eloquently than that, but you know, no, he it wasn't wreckage at all. As he also asked, like, what will happen to all that beauty? That was one of the questions that they often asked. So I think there was a lot of beauty in that wreckage, and it was, again, a privilege to be able to work with it.
And it seems to be that we're coming to understand and appreciate that beauty more now, right?
I do believe so. I mean, yes, there's been a resurgence. I mean, Barry Jenkins' excellent movie, If Beale Street Could Talk, Rahlil Peck's documentary. You know, there have been, you know, Black Lives Matter has brought him into more visibility, and he's become more a part of college curriculums. So, you know, he's Baldwin. That the centennial was an excellent centennial. He had a lot of well-deserved attention, but, you know, as others have said, it's not. There's not a year of Baldwin, right? There's this is the this is a this is a Baldwin era, and we're just beginning to learn from him. So the centennial should is a launching moment rather than a kind of summation.
The name of the book is Baldwin, A Love Story. It is by Nicholas Boggs, published by FSG. Nicholas, what a great pleasure and honor to speak to you. Thank you so much for sharing this morning. A great pleasure, and a great pleasure reading the book and learning so much, and even more so to speak with you this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Baldwin, A Love Story by Nicholas Boggs. It is published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.